are listening to Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren. Welcome, everybody, at redice.tv. You can find our videos, TV episodes, news, and much more. This is, of course, in addition to the radio show that we do several times a week. Also, make sure that you check out redicemembers.com for the full show, the second hour of most of our shows that we've done. And we also have other exclusive materials, such as the live TV show that we are doing on the weekends. Our guest is Jason Reza-Giorgiani. He's one of the co-founders of AltRight.com, and he's a member of its board of directors. He's an Iranian-American and native New Yorker of Persian and Northern European descent. After receiving his BA and MA from the New York University, he completed his doctorate in philosophy at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Jason currently teaches courses on science, technology, and society, and the history of Iran as a full-time faculty member of the New Jersey Institute of Technology. He is a professional member of the Society for Scientific Exploration and works also with the Iranian Renaissance, an organization dedicated to bringing about a cultural revolution in Greater Iran on the basis of the pre-Islamic Persian heritage. And that is, of course, what we're going to talk more about today. We have a lot of topics lined up, so I suspect it is going to be a long show. I also want to mention, though, before we bring Jason on, his first book, Prometheus and Atlas, was published by Arctos in 2016, and later in October of last year, 2016, he became the editor-in-chief of Arctos. So with that, let me welcome back on the show. Jason, thank you so much for coming on with us. It's good to have you back again.
It's a pleasure to be with you again, Henrik. It's been far too long.
Yeah, it has been. We've been talking back and forth, I don't know how long now, Jason, about actually getting you on and talking a bit about the Aryan Imperium and the Iranian Renaissance, and it's come up a couple of times. You know, I think it came up at your talk at MPI. It also came up when we did that first podcast for altright.com. And a lot of people, there's both been misunderstandings. There's also been maybe just exaggerations or what it means or what is this going to mean for like the future of Europe if you had your vision come through and all those kinds of things. So I would like to obviously give you an opportunity here today to explain a bit more about this and maybe explain to people within the alt-right who might be, I don't know, some concern or something about any of this. So I'm really looking forward to this. But in the most basic outline, explain to us what the Iranian Renaissance is, what this movement is that you're involved with, Jason.
Well, the Iranian Renaissance movement is a grassroots, very organic socio-political movement that arose in Iran after the failure of the Islamic reform movement of 1997 to about 2009. Your listeners might remember that in 2009, 2010, there was a massive uprising against the Islamic Republic in Iran that was brutally crushed. And after that incident, the youth of Iran, you know, Iran is one of the youngest countries in the world, 70% under the age of 30, the youth have increasingly turned toward the pre-Islamic Persian heritage of the country as a source for deep-rooted and abiding political change. So the Iranian Renaissance is about a renaissance of pre-Islamic Persian culture and an excavation of the greatness of that culture from out of the so-called Islamic Golden Age and the quote-unquote glory of Islam, which is really an appropriation of the greatness of pre-Islamic Iranian civilization.
Very good. And what, you know, if you had your way, shall we say, I remember you were talking a little bit about this in the podcast, and I guess there was some concern from people on the alt-right. Is any of that justified? What would this mean for, let's say, you know, people in Europe and maybe even America at the end of it, if a new empire, if you will, was set up in Iran? Would that change anything for Europeans, do you think, or for in terms of immigration or anything like this?
It would change a great deal in a positive sense. It would basically crush the greatest strategic enemy of the European people, namely Islam, because the Iranian Renaissance movement is a radically anti-Islamic movement. It aims not only to topple the Islamic Republic as a political regime, but to disestablish Islam as a religion and a culture in Iran and return to the pre-Islamic heritage of the country. So in that sense, it would be tremendously positive for Europeans. And I want to talk about this a little bit more in detail later in the show, but just to outline it briefly, The vision that we have in the Iranian Renaissance of reconstituting Greater Iran or the Persian Empire is not anything that could induce further mass immigration into Europe. The idea that we would reconnect territories that have a Persian heritage stretching from northern India to the Caucasus does not mean that we intend to open some kind of migration corridor between India and Europe.
Right.
Not at all. Not at all.
Right.
You know, the European Economic Community existed long before the abolishing of the borders between European countries in the structure of the European Union. So even if this Greater Iran were to enter into some kind of economic agreement with Europe and India, or some kind of strategic defense agreement on the model of NATO with Europe and India, this doesn't mean an open border policy at all.
Right. Now, let me just remind our listeners as well, and you know this very well, Jason, of course, we had an Iranian revolution back in 1979. And interestingly enough, of course, this was the toppling of the Shah at the time, and it was also referred to as an Islamic revolution. In other words, Iran had been a secular power for some time. I don't even know how long at that stage. But this was, of course, supported by the United States, this revolution to topple him and to create this Islamic state out of Iran, which hadn't been that in many, many, many years. So I think that this is an interesting dynamic. So it would basically be what you're talking about is to kind of restore the rightful kind of type of leadership and type of structure in the country that you had prior to the 1979 Iranian Revolution in a way. Is that correct?
That's right. The Shah, the late Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, whose title, by the way, was Arya Mehr, or Light of the Aryans, he was attempting to bring about an Iranian cultural renaissance from the top down. What we're seeing today is an Iranian renaissance from the bottom up, a grassroots movement. Although there is an organization by the name Iranian Renaissance that I'm involved with that intends to provide a functional structure for this movement and to coordinate its activities more effectively. In fact, the leader of the Iranian Renaissance movement, Shahin Nejad, is going to be coming with me this weekend to the London Forum. We are both going to be giving speeches there. So people who are listening to this broadcast in the future should go and definitely have a listen of Shahin Nejad's speech, because he's going to be outlining not only the vision of the Iranian Renaissance, but his ideas about the way in which the future Iran can be an ally of European nationalists.
Yeah, you know, I do find that very interesting, because we do have a big problem, of course, with Islam and their desire to conquer Europe through immigration, through birth and all these kinds of things. And if we had such a large country as Iran on our side, helping us to kind of remedy the situation, we would be far better off, of course, than without it. But without going into too much in detail in that now, we'll get to some of those points later. Tell us about the meaning of Iran, first of all.
Well, you know, Iran actually doesn't make any sense as a name of a country, because when you say Iran, all you're saying is Aryan. The name of the country is actually Iran Shahr. Iran is just the shorthand, sort of truncated reference to it. Iran Shahr is a Middle Persian or Pahlavi linguistic form of Aryana Khshatra, an ancient Persian. And Aryana, it's quite obviously, means Aryan. And Kshatra, it's related to the Sanskrit word, if your audience, you know, probably does know something about the Hindu caste system. The Kshatriyas are the princely caste, right, in the Hindu caste system. So it has to do with principality, dominion, or imperium. So Aryana Kshatra means Aryan Imperium, and Iran Shahr is the shortened Middle Persian form of it. Iran is like a shorthand reference to that, to Iran Shahr or Aryan Imperium.
So that would be equivalent to saying the Persian Empire in a way, right?
Exactly. So an interesting thing is that the Persians never referred to Iran as the Persian Empire. This was a designation that the Greeks came up with. It's sort of like when you hear in newscasts the correspondents will say, Moscow announced today that they're going to be initiating a lunar program or such and such instead of Russia, right? They refer to the country by its capital district.
Yep.
Well, that's what the Greeks used to do with Iran. The capital district of Iran was Pars. And so they would refer to all of Iran by referring to Pars. And it became, you know, the Empire of Pars or the Persian Empire. But Iranians always called Iran, Iran, and they always called themselves Iranians. So Persian and Iranian are actually not synonymous. If you treat them as if they are, you leave out large groups of Iranians who are not Persians. For example, the Kurds. All of the Kurds are Iranians. The Kurdish people are the folks that the Greeks referred to as Medes, you know, the Median kingdom.
The in-betweens, right?
Yes, yes. And like Medea in Greek mythology, she was from the Median kingdom. We also have the Baluch, another Iranian group. You've got the Ossetians in the Caucasus. And then the Tajiks. The Tajiks are actually just the Persians of Central Asia. Taj means crown. And so this was a way of referring to the fact that they spoke the courtly language, which the Tajiks call Dari, short for Darbari or courtly, the language of the Persian court. But you have all these non-Persian Iranian people. So all Persians are Iranians, but not all Iranians are Persians, even though the Persians have been the culturally dominant group of Iranians for the past 2,500 years.
Yeah, and for those who want to know more about that, by the way, we went through some of this when we did our Rumi video interview together, Jason, and kind of detailed that, of course, Iran in much in a similar ways suffered from a kind of an invasion, much that we're seeing in Europe right now. The demographics have been changed of the country. There's been Islamification, of course, and outpouring in from other people more from the south and such. So we're kind of talking about a root Aryan people here of to a certain extent that has, of course, a lot of in the past related to Europeans. And that's what we call, of course, the Indo-Europeans or the Aryans. But tell us a bit more about the misleading depictions of the Asian persons, how we get them in popular culture.
Well, yeah, that's a good thing to go into. But as you were starting to explain, you know, the Iranians are an Indo-European people. And let me just back up for a minute to clarify what exactly that means in relation to this term Aryan. There's been a lot of confusion and controversy about this, really since the Second World War, but especially in recent years, you know, and even in the alt-right movement. After World War II, there was this move to refer to only the Indo-Iranian branch of the Indo-European family as Aryans. That really is not correct, because the Irish also called themselves Aryans. Just the way that Iran is a short form of Aryana in Persian, Erin is a short form of Aryan in Celtic. And in fact, you know, Iran and Ireland have exactly the same name as countries. In Celtic, Ireland is called Erin, which is a cognate of Iran. So we don't know what the primordial Indo-Europeans called themselves, but the one term that we have in multiple Indo-European languages as a self-designator for these people is Arya, Arya or Aryan or Erin or Iran. And so it's a perfectly appropriate name to refer to the entire Indo-European community, especially because it's a beautiful name. It means finely wrought, well put together, well crafted, crafty, skillful, and by extension, noble. So I take Aryan to be a designation for the entire Indo-European family.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously there is a racial component here, but it also seems to involve traits, because if we look at these early Caucasians, they seem to have been the civilization builders, right? I mean, if we look back in the ancient world, it's obvious that Iran was the Persian Empire, if we call it that, just for the sake of mapping it on the map, so to speak. That's where a lot of the root of civilization was coming out of, that part of the ancient world. So I can very well imagine that this is also a designation maybe that other people put on them. And as you said before, with the naming of the Persian Empire, so many times, Jason, we get both the enemies, but also neighbors defining and coming up with a name for a tribe or for a country or for a people. That's so common.
Yes, and it's very important to point out, as you did, that Indo-Europeans are Caucasians and vice versa. You know, there are these bizarre theories these days in India that are inspired by anti-colonialist resentment, where somehow the Aryans came from the Indus River Valley, and, you know, I don't know what they looked like Indian people today do, and then somehow there was a genetic mutation, and they migrated toward Europe, and all this kind of nonsense. No, this has been very clearly analyzed, and the predominant theories have the Indo-European community either originating in the Caucasus or in Ukraine, or some area in between the two. At one point, the other side of the Caspian Sea was also a hypothesis that some scholars ventured. But, you know, that's actually not very far from the Caucasus. If you look on a map, that part of Central Asia is just across the Caspian Sea from the Caucasus. At any rate...
But let me just interject quickly. Have you ever heard of Arata or Arata as a civilization?
Sure.
Yeah, but it was somewhere in the Ukraine, which is a very, very ancient... people that lived there. And it's very possible, of course, that these dispersed out into the different locations and eventually became, you know, what we call the Iranians today. But anyway, that's beside the point.
It's not an aside at all. In fact, because you see the Ar root in Arata, right? The Ar root is exactly what's in Arya. And it's also in Aristos in Greek, the root of the word aristocrat. And also arete, the word for virtue in classical Greek. And in classical Greek, virtue didn't mean like good, like goody two shoes. It meant having your stuff together, like, you know, having your life in order and living a well-crafted life. Again, going back to that idea of the well put together, the finely wrought and noble. So yeah, arata, arya, arete, and Aristos, these are all related concepts. But at any rate, these folks were Caucasians. They were white people. They came from somewhere between Ukraine and the Caucasus. And it's important to remember that for most of history, until the mid-1800s, which is yesterday in terms of the history of Iran, right? In terms of the 3,000-year history of Iran, the 1850s is yesterday. Until the Tsarist Russian conquest of the Caucasus in the mid-1800s, all of the Caucasus was inside Iran. The Caucasus is northwestern Iran and has been for the past 3,000 years. So the point of origin, and then the other interesting thing is that Ukraine is also Iranian. See, in the map of the Iranian world, there are two major spheres. There's the territory that was part of the various Persian empires. There were about four, maybe five different Persian empires. And then there's a vast stretch of territory above the Persian empires that was inhabited by these people called the Scythians. The Scythians were northern Iranian barbarians. They were like the Vikings of the Iranian world. They were very free-spirited. They never wanted to submit themselves to a central governmental authority. And yet they were ethnically Iranian, culturally Iranian, and there were several Scythian invasions of the heartland of Iran, where after periods of decline, the Scythians were responsible for revitalizing the Persian Empire. They would come down, they would adopt the Persian language, and they would, as it were, inject fresh blood into the civilization. And these are the periods when you saw renaissances in the ancient Persian culture. So the Scythians are an Iranian people, and the Scythian homeland is Ukraine. The basis of the Ukrainian nation are the Scythians. So either way you look at it, whether the Indo-Europeans are from the Caucasus or whether they're from Ukraine or somewhere in between, the whole Indo-European community comes from out of the greater Iran region.
Yeah, exactly. Northern, north of the Black Sea. I find this period extremely interesting. I've always been interested in the Scythians, but it might be Scythians. I don't know how you pronounce that, but I've looked at their art and things like this. I've looked at some older depictions that they had of some of their, costumes and weaponry and how they looked and things like this. And there's just so many tremendous similarities to You can see that mutations have occurred later when these people become probably up in the Celtic regions, later in the northern world, in Scandinavia and things like this. And there's so many cultural similarities, Jason. I just find this period so very interesting.
Yeah, the Scythians are one of the strongest points of connection between Iranian and European branches of the Aryan family. And that's something that we'll come back to a little bit later on. But you were asking me about misleading depictions of the Persians with respect to this whole racial question. And although I appreciate the 300 Frank Miller films from a technical standpoint, I think they look fantastic. And they're very well put together as films. But their depiction of the Persians is perverse and grotesquely inaccurate. Basically, what they've done is they have recast the contemporary conflict between Europe and the Arab Muslim world in terms of this ancient conflict between the Greeks and the Persians. And from a racial standpoint, it's just totally inaccurate. I mean, you've got these images of all kinds of mongrel non-white peoples in the Persian Empire. Xerxes looks like some kind of, I don't know what you know, subhuman creature, you know, with all his piercings and his
decked out.
Anyway, it's just he looked nothing like that. We have stone carvings of him. We have classical Greek descriptions of Xerxes. The ancient Persians looked exactly like the Greeks. This was a conflict, at least they looked like the Aryan Greeks. I mean, the Minoans may be another story, the people who lived on Crete. But the wars between the Greeks and the Persians were like the wars between the Italians and the Germans, or between the Roman Empire and the Celts. It was what you could call white-on-white violence. It had
fratricide. Nothing
like a racial dimension. Exactly, fratricide, yes. It had nothing like a racial dimension to it.
I always felt, Jason, that in that movie, they did it because they put that in a modern contextual symbolic gesture by saying this is like, you know, let's take the foundation of like your European civilization, which is, you know, in the current standard, like, oh, it's the Greeks, right? And then they took this battle and they transposed like the Islamic threat that now is happening to Europe. And transpose that over the Persian Empire. Do you see what I'm saying? It's almost like it's not meant to be historically accurate. It was kind of almost meant more to say, let's take an old battle and let's say that this is stuff that's been happening in the past.
Yes, that's exactly what they did, but it's extremely dangerous. And it's actually very undermining because, that's not the origin of our civilization. If you really think about it, at least what the alt-right represents in terms of, the heritage of Western civilization is more closely aligned with the fundamental principles of the Persian Empire than it was with the ideals of Athens. And, you know, the Spartans actually came very close to allying with the Persians against the Athenians because of the convergence of Spartan and Persian values. So, you know, one of the most interesting things about the ancient history of Iran with respect to Europe is this profound transformation that took place in Greek culture during and after the Persian colonization. A lot of the things that we see as characteristic of Western civilization are entirely lacking in Greece before the Persian invasion. If you look at the Iliad, for example, I mean, you have a group of people who are startlingly lacking in any sense of individual conscience, autonomous decision-making. They believe their lives are governed by fate. They treat prisoners of war horrendously. There's no trace of higher intellectual culture or contemplation of the nature of the cosmos. And they're a slave-driving people. You know, the Athenian society, even much later, was entirely based on slavery. So that you would depict the Persians as basically imperial slavers and Greece as the bastion of freedom is completely anachronistic. When you read Herodotus, you see very clearly that the Greek intellectuals were looking to the higher ideals of Persian civilization, to the humanitarian vision of Persian civilization, as something that could liberate them from the more xenophobic and more kind of, how could I put it, nativist views that had dominated them for generations. Mm-hmm. So you had really an opening of horizon and perspective in Greece through the Persian colonization.
Tell us a bit about the differences here then, because you were kind of alluding to, and I think we see this in history quite often, to be honest, there is an overlap as one part of the world becomes more dominant, culturally speaking, and they do, you know, past civilizations, the greatness of those, to a certain extent, do stand on the shoulders of giants, so to speak, that it seems to have been a root origin point at some point, and then the highlights of civilization, when the Renaissance spreads in different part of the world at different times, it is always have been lent to a certain extent. So how would you compare, let's say, then, something like the European Renaissance and the Iranian Renaissance? What time are we talking about when we're talking about the Iranian Renaissance?
What time are we talking about in terms of the contemporary movement of the Iranian Renaissance? Or,
well, it depends on which one of them you want to talk about. Because I was thinking, of course, in the ancient world, like if there was an older kind of... there was at some point where civilization was blooming in Iran and the Renaissance, kind of a form of Renaissance, started up there. How far back do we need to go then to find that?
Well, I mean, there was an attempt at an Iranian Renaissance after the Arab Muslim conquest. But, you know, before we talk about the demise of, you know, the ancient civilization of pre-Islamic Iran and then the way in which Persians attempted to resuscitate that under the dominion of the caliphate, let's give our listeners some sense of what ancient Iranian civilization was like and the various ways in which it influenced Europe. We were talking about the Persian colonization of Greece and transformation in Greek culture. The real starting point for that is the Prometheus trilogy of Aeschylus, where you have this titan elevated to the status of a culture hero, even though he is a rebel against the godfather of the Greek pantheon, namely Zeus. And the ethos that is epitomized by Prometheus and that later winds up being definitive of the Faustian character of Western civilization can actually be traced back to Zoroastrianism. It can be traced back to Zarathustra, who is the founder, really, of Iranian civilization. So far as we have been able to discern, Zarathustra lived somewhere between 1500 and 1200 BC in the Caucasus. He was from the Caucasus, and he was badly persecuted for his revolutionary spiritual message, so he had to emigrate to Central Asia. So the whole span between the one side of the Caspian Sea and the other was a geographical locale for this man's life. Zarathustra is a revolutionary figure, spiritually and philosophically speaking. He inverts the Indo-European pantheon. He winds up demonizing the devas or the gods and claiming that they are promulgators of deceit, bent on a kind of sadistic manipulation of mankind, that they're unworthy overlords. And he opposes to them this titan of wisdom, Ahura Mazda. Ahura is a cognate of the Sanskrit word Ashura, which means titan. And Mazda means wisdom. And the defining quality of Ahura Mazda is Spenta Menu, or the creative mentality, the progressive mentality, or the spirit of innovation. And he symbolizes this with fire. Zarathustra symbolizes this with fire, which of course is also key to the myth of Prometheus. I think this is the light of knowledge in the long dark night, especially the cold winter nights of a place like the Caucasus. But it's also the fire of the forge, which is why it would be associated, you know, with the innovative spirit, the spirit of, you know, technical development and the improvement of living conditions through craftiness. And so the fundamental struggle in human existence is between this titan of wisdom and the predominating spirit of the devas, the deceptive gods, which Zarathustra characterizes as Angra Menu, the constricted or constraining spirit. It's later contracted in Persian to Ahriman. So it's a kind of dualistic view. And that's very important because since Ahura Mazda is not an omnipotent or an omniscient God, we really do have free will. And our conscientious discernment and free choice to be the champions of the advancement of wisdom and knowledge on the earth, that choice is essential to how history is going to turn out. We really do add to the world in a fundamental way. So there's a direction in history. We're going somewhere. The progressive mentality also is a goal-oriented teleological view of sort of creative evolution in the cosmos. But our decisions are key to how the successive epochs of history unfold and to how the story is eventually going to end. It's a very heroic attitude that you see in this kind of worldview. You know, it is not a spiritual doctrine for weak people who want an all-powerful God to take care of them so long as they have faith. It requires a kind of heroic and intrepid spirit to commit to this vision of the world.
You know, the symbol of Ahura Mazda is a flying sun disk or the winged disk. And it's, of course, a very fiery theme, of course. Sometimes it's depicted with sun rays behind him. It's a very kind of a proto-Christian as well, to a certain extent. And this very aspect that he demonized the old gods, if you will, to a certain extent, it's also indicative of almost a movement towards a kind of a monotheism. You mentioned, of course, the duality of that's very, you know, I think good that they kept that. But I know to this day, Jason, that there's places in Iran that still keeps some of these fires alive, right? I think it's called the Attar. It's one of these divine fires or divine sparks or holy fire that still is burning. I think there's even a specific temple where they still keep this tradition alive today, and there's a man that lives in this temple, and all he does is tend to this fire. Do you know about this?
Yeah, I've been there. It's in Yazd, in Iran.
Very nice.
And, you know, they're a very interesting one in the so-called Republic of Azerbaijan as well, where, I think it's lit by gas coming out of the rocks. So these fires burn perpetually without even being tended. We'll come to this a little bit later, but, you know, of course, this so-called Republic of Azerbaijan is a part of Iran that was colonized by the Russians in the 1800s. And Azerbaijan itself, it's a kind of Turkic corruption of Atar Paygah, or Stronghold of the Fire. So this is actually the region that Zarathustra is from. Zarathustra is from around Lake Urumiye, in Atar Paygah or Azerbaijan.
Interesting. Yeah, I definitely have some points on some of the cultural references in Azerbaijan and how it relates to the north. But do you want to move on and talk about Cyrus a bit? I mean, if we're talking about kind of some of the sources of the Iranian Renaissance, you mentioned Zarathustra a little bit, unless you want to say more about him. Do you want to move along to Cyrus?
Yeah, let me say a couple more things, bouncing off of what you were talking about in terms of that symbol, the winged disc. That symbol is called the Farvahar, and it's an image of the perfected human soul, or rather of the human soul flying on the way toward perfection. Zarathustra is inside that winged disc, and he is holding the ring of the promise of spiritual completion in one hand, and his other hand is pointing forwards. Onwards and forwards. So there's a kind of path to spiritual perfection that's outlined by Zarathustra. And very briefly, it involves six principles. And you could see these as six rays of the light of Spentamenu, or the progressive mentality. The first of them is Asha, or Arta, which means cosmic order. And it's the idea that there's a rational order in the cosmos. The idea of natural law. And this is symbolized by fire. And the second one of these is Vohumena, or the best thinking. A contraction of Vohumena is Humana, And, you know, this word humanitas that we have in the Latinate branch of the Indo-European languages really epitomizes what is meant by the older Avestan term vohumena. And that's that you only properly become a human being if you cultivate your mind. What differentiates us from animals is our intellectual faculty. And so to cultivate our reason so that we can grasp the rational order of the cosmos, so that we can discern Asha, that is what it means to have vohumena, or the best thinking. When the best thinking is reflected not just in an individual, but in a justly governed society, then you have what Zarathustra calls kshatra verya, or the desirable dominion. And you'll notice this term kshatra and kshatra verya is the same as Aryana Kshatra, dominion or imperium.
Right.
And so this desirable dominion or choice-worthy kingship is basically a utopian conception of a just society. And it's a true aristocracy, not an oligarchy, not rule of the wealthy, but rule of the best people, which really would mean the wisest people. Then you've got the next three of them, which are very closely connected with each other. One is, by the way, Kshatravarya is associated with metal. So if Asha is associated with fire, you can connect this with Kshatravarya in that the metal of a sword, say, is fired in a forge. The metal of the sword of the just ruler of the just society is fired in the is forged rather in the fire of Asha. Yeah. Or a proper understanding of cosmic order. And the last three of these, Horvatat, or wholeness, Spandarmat, or serenity, and Ameritat, or vitality, are all connected to each other, and they're relevant to Zarathustra's ecological vision. Spandarmat, or Spentarmaiti, means ever-deepening serenity. It's the idea that the more you align yourself with cosmic order through right thinking, the more a kind of calm descends on you, the more deeply rooted in the earth you are. The symbol of this one of these Amesha Spentas, or bounteous immortals, is the earth. And it's this Amesha Spenta, this one of the bounteous immortals, these fundamental principles that are like archetypes, is always feminine. So it's a Mother Earth kind of archetype. Spenta Armaiti. And then you have Horvatat, which is symbolized by water, like holy water. Holy, of course, in English comes from hail or whole. And it's the idea of the health that comes with being deeply rooted in truth and justice. And then finally, you have Ameritat, which is often translated as immortality, but literally it means undeadness or vitality. The vitality that comes with serenity and health. So this is a kind of a path to spiritual perfection, to becoming that thing that's symbolized by the winged disc, your perfected form at the end of history. And interestingly, to this day, these fundamental principles, these six Amesha Spentas, together with Spenta Menu, which they're all rays of, as the seventh one, considered as the seventh, the progressive mentality itself, these are embodied, they are represented by various items on the Persian New Year altar, the Haftsin, or seven S's, S standing for Spenta, the seven Spentas. These are all symbolized by items on the Persian New Year altar, which is set up around the spring equinox. So it's one very important way in which the Zoroastrian tradition has remained alive in Iran throughout the centuries.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there's actually certain traditions that have overlapped much in that we have pagan traditions in the north that have survived despite Christian Reformation and these kinds of things. How is it with the language, though? Just a quick note on that. Does these words that you use, are they still as is within the Persian language, or has this also transformed over time?
They have Middle Persian forms. So some of the terminology I used was more ancient from the time of Zarathustra, but these all have Middle Persian forms that are also from Zoroastrian Empire, the Sasanian Empire, and they've survived in those forms, in fact, as the name of 6 of the 12 months of the year.
Oh, interesting.
So they're very commonly used. 6 of the 12 months of the year are named after these Amesha Spentas or bounteous immortals, these 6 archetypes that are like rays of the light of the progressive or innovative mentality characterizing Ahura Mazda.
All right, let's move along here. Otherwise, we'll never get through, Jason. Cyrus, tell us about Cyrus the Great.
Yeah, so Cyrus the Great is the founder of the Persian Empire. And Cyrus also highlights the connection between the Persians and the Medes, or in today's terminology, the Persians and the Kurds. Cyrus's mother was a Mede or Kurd. And he basically, to make a long story short, led a revolt against the Median kingdom. The Medes had a kingdom for about 600 years before the Persians, and the Persians were more nomadic pastoral people. At the time of Cyrus and led by Cyrus, they wind up taking over the Median kingdom, and then due to his extraordinary statesmanship and competence as a military leader, dramatically expanding this kingdom into a vast empire that incorporated many other peoples. Cyrus was considered by Greek authors contemporary to him and in the generation after him as the ideal statesman. Xenophon wrote a book called Cyropedia, or The Education of Cyrus, which holds up Cyrus the Great as the ideal statesman. And this has to do in large part with his extraordinary humanitarianism. He's the first guy who did not pursue a punitive policy toward conquered enemies. He would never plunder an enemy territory. There were never any mass executions. In fact, generally speaking, whenever Cyrus would conquer a rival kingdom, he would improve the living conditions of the subjugated population. So it got to the point where, in some cases, when people heard that Cyrus was on his way, the military would just lay down their arms because they were chafing under some unjust tyrant, and they knew that Cyrus was going to come and improve living conditions for them. He even, in several cases, spared the lives of kings that he conquered and turned them into his close advisors. This was the case with Croesus of Lydia, for example. So Cyrus is the point of origin for this Persian tradition of humanitarianism that's often conflated these days with human rights. People describe the founding charter of the Persian Empire, the Cyrus Cylinder, as the first charter of human rights. But there are serious conceptual problems with the modern European Enlightenment notion of human rights that don't really apply to the humanitarianism of Cyrus, which is rooted in Zarathustra's ethos and worldview.
There's a demand for improvement. There's a pressure on you as a human being to become more, or you know, to, as you said before, separate yourself from the animal kingdom and actually use your logic and your rationality, your wisdom, and these kinds of things. Today, none of this is incorporated into this issue of human rights. You're just to be given things. There's no obligations put on you as a human within the civilization, within the society, to better yourself. So this is definitely something from the ancient world that we've lost, or this is something we have given up on today, unfortunately.
That's right. I mean, in the modern conception of universal human rights, there's this unqualified right to freedom of religion. Well, suppose that a large group of people believe in a religion that's fundamentally anti-humanitarian. Suppose a large group believe in an inhuman religion, right? I mean, how is that a coherent political ideology? Whereas Cyrus and the ancient Persian emperors that followed him, like Darius and Xerxes, they saw a well-governed empire as a walled garden. And in a walled garden or a walled, agricultural area, you can have many different flowers or crops growing together. But you need to weed the garden and you need to keep pests out. This was the ancient Persian imperial philosophy that goes back to Kshatriya in Zarathustra's thought, or Shahrivar. So, you know, you can have many different ethnicities, people of many different religions living within the same imperial realm, but there are going to be people and doctrines that cannot coexist with others. And so you have to keep them out. Otherwise, you're going to be compromising the stability of the entire system. You're going to be introducing something that's going to, you know, basically destroy all of the crops that are growing within this garden. And this garden concept was referred to as paridaiza in ancient Persian, which is where we get the word paradise from in English.
Very interesting. Right, so let's move then in terms of the sources, the inspirations of the Iranian Renaissance from the BC into the AD, if you will, and talk about Ferdowsi, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. He lived around, what, 940 or so, turn of the first millennium. Tell us more about him.
Yeah, so the third major influence on the Iranian Renaissance, the third major source for this Iranian cultural revolution that's taking place today, after Zarathustra and Cyrus, or the other Persian emperors, is Ferdowsi. Ferdowsi, or Pardisi, if we want to translate his name back to pure Persian, Ferdowsi was a poet of the 1000s, in Khorasan, which in today's geography is an area that stretches between northeastern Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. He lived in northeastern Iran in a town called Tus, and where his tomb is today. And he embarked upon a 30-year project of putting together a Persian national epic using almost exclusively Persian vocabulary. This was after 200 years of Arab-Muslim colonization. And, you know, the Arabs had imposed their language on the Persian people, which is why all of these so-called Muslim scientists of the Islamic Golden Age, who are actually Persians, were forced to write in Arabic. So you had a long period where Persian had been prohibited in terms of high intellectual discourse, because all of the scientific texts were being commissioned by the caliphate, right?
Interesting.
So the language was dying, and Ferdowsi almost single-handedly saved the Persian language by composing this gigantic epic that consists of pre-Islamic lore and effectively the history of Iran prior to the Arab invasion, using a relatively pure Persian vocabulary. And then many poets after him emulated him, and it led to a renaissance of the Persian language and was the wellspring of this fantastic tradition of Persian poetry that lasted for hundreds of years.
Right. So where do we go from here in terms of outlining what the Iranian Renaissance or the Aryan Imperium is about?
So Ferdowsi's Shahnameh is interesting because it also connects the Persians and the Scythians, those northern barbarians that I was talking about earlier, who always lived outside the scope of the Persian Empire, but who occasionally came down and revitalized it. The Achaemenid dynasty, the ancient Persian emperors from the time of classical Greece, are conspicuously missing in the Shahnameh, in the Persian national epic. And it's believed that this is because the Shahnameh is really the epic literature of the Scythian people. So there are two major divisions of this monumental text. One of them is referred to as historical because we can clearly correlate the figures there with names and dates of kings that are in the historical record. That begins with the Parthians. The Parthians, then the Sasanian dynasty, these are very clearly historical figures in the Shahnameh. But what takes place in the Shahnameh before the rise of the Parthian dynasty is hard to map onto to any history that we have. And that's because it's the history of the Scythian kings and the Scythian culture. So what happened in Iran after the Greek colonization that was spearheaded by Alexander is that the Scythians came down from these northern territories toward Ukraine, and they established a new Persian dynasty that revitalized Persian culture after this period of Greek colonization. So the reason that the Shahnameh is closely correlated with history only beginning with the Parthians is that it's the moment when the Scythians come and make Persian history their own. And so although the Scythians were displaced by Turkic and other Asiatic people in the vast territories of Central Asia that were their homeland, the Scythian mentality has survived into contemporary Iran through the poem that Ferdowsi composed. And if you look at these stories about kings and heroes, you find a lot of commonality between the mentality of this Persian epic literature and the chivalric ethos of medieval Europe, the attitude that the Germanic tribes and the Vikings had. This is not an accident, because a branch of the Scythians, known as the Sarmatians, wound up emigrating from Ukraine, from their cradle, all the way across Europe together with the Goths. The Sarmatian branch of the Scythians, who called themselves Alans, migrated across Europe. They rode across Europe together with the Goth horsemen, and they established a joint kingdom in Spain that they called Gothalania, which later wound up being called Catalonia. And another branch of these Scythians were taken prisoner by the Romans and wound up in northern France and in the British Isles. And they have been identified by some scholars as the point of origin for the Arthurian mythos, because many of the key symbols, like the grail and the sword and the stone, appear much earlier in Scythian culture. So the Scythians, are an interesting connection between the Europeans and the Iranians. And their mentality left its imprint on Iranian culture through the Shahnameh, through the Persian national epic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested in this time period and what it was that caused these people to, in some cases, team up and migrate vast distances to conquer different tribes. And there's a lot of things that are hidden and forgotten in the record, unfortunately. And speaking to that for a moment, how are things in the Iranian record when the Islamic incursion occurred? Was there, as far as you know, a lot of material that was lost, things maybe that were written down? I was thinking about, some of the traditions that you're mentioning now. Is much of that still in existence and written down that we can refer to, or has things been lost and burnt when Islam came in?
Unfortunately, a great deal was lost and burned when the Muslims came in. They went around torching libraries. We do have some historical records, but we suffered the kind of episode that the Greco-Roman world suffered with the burning of the Library of Alexandria and other institutions like that. The same kind of thing happened during the Arab Muslim conquest of Iran.
Yeah, and you see what happens now with ISIS just recently here. They're blowing up some major parts in Palmyra. They're destroying the old Roman theaters and things like this. It's a travesty that these people are, controlling certain areas of this ancient world. This is our common joint heritage that are being lost to these people, to these brutal savages.
It is, and we'll talk more about this maybe in the second half, but it's important to point out that both the territories where the Islamic State is destroying, monuments in Iraq and parts of Syria, and the areas where Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were, say, demolishing the Bamiyan Buddhas, right?
Yeah.
In Central Asia and Afghanistan. These are Iranian territories. These are part of Greater Iran. I was just talking about the Scythians who founded the Parthian dynasty. Well, the administrative center of the Parthian dynasty was actually between Syria and Iraq in present-day political geography. So this was a Persian dynasty. I mean, there were Iranians ethnically who came down, adopted the Persian language, and restarted the Persian Empire, founded the Second Persian Empire. But their base of operations was between present-day Syria and Iraq. So all these monuments that the Islamic State is demolishing in Iraq and in Syria, many of them at any rate, are are from the Parthian period. And on the other side of Iran, in the east, the Bamiyan Buddhas that were destroyed by the Taliban are the legacy of a people called the Kushans. They are another branch of these Scythians who came down and settled in northern India as Iranian people, and who adopted Buddhism, but then radically transformed it from the Theravada or Hinayana doctrine of Siddhartha into what we call Mahayana Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism involves a number of fundamental innovations that reflect the Iranian mentality. And King Kanishka of the Kushan dynasty was responsible for organizing the conference where various scholars constructed this new doctrine. And so the whole artistic and architectural legacy of the Kushans is falling prey to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and parts of northern Pakistan today. That is also within the sphere that in the Iranian Renaissance we refer to as Greater Iran.
Interesting. The Scythian seems to be definitely a node point, and was on such a scale in terms of the territory that they managed to kind of throw under themselves, that this seems to be a central point in a common heritage, if you will, Jason, that these people deserve way more focus, maybe. They deserve way more attention, and maybe we can discover some kind of common root if you look at the Scythians and what they managed to do.
Yes, well, you know, the Scythians, their name in their own language was Seka, and son, obviously means descendant or, offspring. And so some people have ventured the theory that the term Saxon comes from Seka Sun, the offshoot or offspring of the Seka, because the Saxons originate at the time when the Scythians and the Goths basically are traveling together, setting out from an area between Ukraine and the Baltic and migrating westward. So, yeah, you have a territorial scope that extends from the Saxony in Europe all the way down to the Kushan kingdom in northern India. And the best way, I think, to think about these Scythians is that although they were relatively, quote-unquote, uncultured, I mean, they were roaming barbarians, they were genetically the purest Iranians. So, there were people in Iran before the Persians and the Medes showed up there. There were Neolithic peoples who are non-Indo-European. And although the Persians and the Medes arrived there in very large numbers so that they basically drowned out these indigenous Iranians, these older non-Indo-European civilizations, there was still some mixture of the Persians with these Elamites or other early cultures on the Iranian plateau. Whenever the Scythians would come down, it was like an injection of pure, Indo-European blood back into Iranian civilization. And I think it's hardly an accident that these are the moments when we see a revitalization of Persian culture.
Yeah, they domesticated the horse. They covered a great amount of length. And of course, when we talk about the Aryan invasion, or like the theories about the Kurgans and these kinds of things, we definitely need to harken back and focus on the Scythians for sure. What about the Sasanian Empire? What about the connection to that?
So the Sasanian Empire, actually the Sasanians used to use these Scythians as their greatest horsemen. They were like the elite troops, the special forces of the Sasanian Empire. Whenever the Sasanians were in a particularly bad bind in a battle with the Byzantines or in India or whatever, they would draw from the Caucasus and bring down some of these Scythian cavalry, these Scythian archers, to basically demolish their enemy. The Sasanians were the high point of pre-Islamic Persian culture. They are the Persian Empire that was conquered by the Arab Muslims in the 650s AD. And the Sasanian Empire was founded by a certain Ardashir Babakan, who adopted Zoroastrianism as the state religion of the empire because he saw that Christianity was coming to dominance in Rome, in the Roman Empire, and he felt threatened by this. The Romans were sending proselytizers into Iran, particularly in the Caucasus and what wound up becoming Armenia, and Ardashir was afraid that the Abrahamic revelation would wind up worming its way into Iran. And so whereas the Parthians, this Parthian dynasty that the Scythians established, had no official religion, and they were de facto Mithraists, they adhered to a kind of very syncretistic, very open pagan religion that you could loosely describe as Mithraism, but that had a lot of Greco-Roman elements to it toward the west, and that in some way blended into Mahayana Buddhism in the east. Ardashir thought that Iran needed a more stable, more fortifying state religion to protect itself from the Abrahamic revelation. And so he reestablished Zoroastrianism as the, or rather for the first time officially established Zoroastrianism as the state religion of Iran. And despite that fact, you had two very interesting heterodox movements take place in the Sasanian period. One was Manichaeism and the other was Mazdakism. And I think we should say something about Manichaeism because it also has deeply influenced European civilization. Mani was a religious teacher, a spiritual visionary from Babylon, from the capital district of the Sasanian Empire. At that time, it was referred to as Ctesiphon, but it's basically the old Babylon. And Mani reflected on the Old Testament, which by this time he was familiar with, and he came up with the conclusion that there's no way that this Christ figure could be an emissary of Jehovah, that there was too stark a contradiction between the gospel of love and transcendent spiritual perfection in the New Testament and a kind of sadistic brutality and, extremely litigious cast of mind that we see in the Old Testament. So he actually identified Jesus as a Saoxiant or savior figure in the Zoroastrian tradition. He thought that both Gautama Buddha and Jesus Christ were saviors following Zarathustra and in the line of Zarathustra, which of course, you could find some evidence for in the fact that the three Magi, right, who visit Jesus at his birth are three Zoroastrian priests. Mm-hmm. Magi is a term for a Zoroastrian or Mithraic priest. So he came up with this very heterodox Gnostic form of Christianity that spread all the way into through the Caucasus, into Europe, first into Bulgaria, and became the Bogomil Gnostic heresy there, and then ultimately reached the south of France, where it gave birth to Catharism. The Cathars are probably a Manichaean sect.
Interesting.
And it's terribly important because, the Cathar and Bogomil heresies were the catalyst for the Inquisition on the part of the Catholic Church. The institution of the Holy Inquisition was established in order to eradicate the quote-unquote Manichees.
Yeah, that's interesting. So it's like a kind of a origin point of some of the Gnostic traditions seem to come from this region as well. And this spread, as far as you said, even into, I think, Britain had some kind of, were picked up on this tradition. But in context to, what we're talking about here in terms of the Iranian Renaissance, it's like these kinds of ideas and these kinds of philosophies and ideologies and everything else have been tremendously attacked throughout the ages. They've been opposing them. They've been clamped down. Empires have turned on them. And yet somehow some of these traditions seem to have continued, Jason. Why are they not allowed to teach these ideas and to learn about them? What is it that's so dangerous about these?
Well, because we live in a world dominated by the Abrahamic revelation. I was about to say the Abrahamic tradition, but I corrected myself because I see it as a counter tradition. It really is, it's a perversion of tradition. And if the Abrahamic value system is what defines, morality, then obviously these ideas are going to be seen as heretical, and they're going to be ruthlessly persecuted. The people who embody these ideals are going to be ruthlessly persecuted. So, what Europeans refer to as the Faustian ethos or the Promethean mentality, that really is at the core of Iranian civilization, going back to Zarathustra. And even in somebody like Mani, although you see a kind of pacifism and asceticism that may not be socially constructive in Mani, it's still the response of the Aryan soul to the image of God that we get from the Bible, especially from the Old Testament. If you come to be convinced that a God like Jehovah really created and ruled the world, then you're going to wind up having this very ascetic, transcendental kind of view, because you'll see this earth as a prison. In a way, this is an unfortunate perversion of Zarathustra's teaching. It's as if Ahriman, the antagonistic, constraining spirit in the teaching of Zarathustra, has come to be seen as the lord and ruler of this world. And Ahura Mazda really winds up not a moral antagonist of this demiurge, but a kind of metaphysical counter-principle. And so you wind up with the distinction between a realm of light and a realm of darkness, a realm of spirit and the fallen material world. These kinds of dualistic ideas have a lot to do with the culture clash between ancient Iran and the encroaching Abrahamic tradition or Abrahamic revelation.
Right. Now, do you want to talk more about the anti-Arab insurgency in Azerbaijan that occurred there? I know nothing about that.
Yeah, so, the Manichaean response to the Abrahamic revelation, fortunately, wasn't the only one. There was a much more militant, more socially engaged reaction against the Abrahamic infiltration of Iran through the Arab Muslim conquest. And you see that more than anything else in the insurgency organized by Babak Khurramdin. Babak Khurramdin lived in the early 800s, and he was a military leader in the Azerbaijan province who held out against the Arab conquerors. He led a community of people who are described by the Arab religious scholars, by the Arab theologians, as Mazdakites. This term Mazdakite refers to one of the other prominent heterodox figures of the Sasanian period, Mazdak. Mazdak was a preacher against the feudal class structure of the Sasanian society, and he was trying to restore, in his view, certain elements of Zarathustra's teaching that weren't adequately reflected by the Zoroastrian state orthodoxy of the Sasanians. And there's a really strong emphasis on social justice, egalitarianism, in the sense of a camaraderie of free spirits in the Mazdakite doctrine. And there's also a really significant reverence for women. Women are treated as the equals of men in Mazdakite communities. You know, the ancient Greeks used to make fun of the Persians because they considered them under the thumb of their women. Persian women, very much like Viking women, were considered very headstrong, and men would always consult with them before making important decisions. They had a significant role in society. They even were involved in military campaigns. You have
that seems to be the case. Yeah.
Yeah. In the Shahnameh, you have female knights. And in the ancient Persian Empire, the time of the Greeks, you had female military commanders, like, for example, the naval admiral Artemisia. So at any rate, the Mazdakite communities in the Sasanian period had retained this reverence for women, this respect for women, and, you know, treating them on more or less an equal footing with men. And this was another characteristic of the community that Babak managed to carve out in Azerbaijan, resisting the Arab Muslim invasion. It's one of the reasons why it was described as a Mazdakite community. The women in those in that mountainous area of Azerbaijan were very resistant to being subjugated by Islam and living in accordance with Islamic doctrine. So this guy wound up successfully waging an insurgency for decades against the Arabs. And he's remembered as a hero of the national resistance to the Islamic conquest.
Yeah, interesting. You know, I don't know that much about Azerbaijan. I know that there's some really interesting cultural spots there, like Gobustan, where they have these rock carvings, which is just like very, very similar to those that we get up in Scandinavia, probably from the early settlement periods. And there's other similarities there where some people actually, you know, we're speculating that the term Azir is where we get the Norse word of Asir from, which is, of course, one of the major tribes or the group of gods in the Norse pantheon. But you said something earlier that the word Azerbaijan was kind of a perversion. It was a change that occurred at some point.
Yeah, that's right. I doubt that etymological connection to the Norse tradition, because Azerbaijan is a Turkic linguistic corruption of either Atarpaygah or Azerpadegah, which means fire stronghold, the foothold or the stronghold of the fire, the eternal fire that's the symbol of Zoroastrianism. And because, of course, this is the place where Zarathustra comes from. And also, like yeah. I mentioned earlier, they have some natural, like, gas wells that create fire in the mountains of, you know, Azerbaijan.
Interesting.
But it's interesting, you know, that in terms of Babak, that this is not the only time when Persian culture was revitalized from out of the Caucasus. Much later on, after a gulf of 800 years of Arab, Turkic, and Mongol colonization in the Safavid period, Iran returns as a distinct political entity. You know, after the Arab Muslim conquest, you had various fiefdoms who tried to carve out some degree of autonomy from the Arabian Caliphate. And they were dealt a devastating blow when the Turks and the Mongols invaded Iran a couple hundred years after the Arabs in the 1000s and then the 1200s in the case of the Mongols. So Iran did not regain its autonomy, politically speaking, until the 1400s, when Shah Ismail, in the late 1400s, establishes the Safavid dynasty. And Shah Ismail is, again, from Azerbaijan. We have a European painting of him which shows that he is a Caucasian person with red hair, totally indistinguishable from a European. And I hardly think it's an accident that, you know, again, it was a group of people from the Caucasus who, with an unbelievable military capability, wound up reunifying what had been Iran, and then adopting the Shahnameh essentially as their political charter or as the defining text of the Sasanian dynasty. They commissioned many beautifully illustrated editions of the Shahnameh, which again is a compendium of pre-Islamic Persian history and culture. So the Caucasus is really important to Iranian history. In fact, there's this expression that the Caucasus is the head of Iran. the only place that you can find any remnant of the Scythian people after they were displaced by the Turks and the Mongols who invaded Central Asia is in the Caucasus in Georgia. You have this population called the Ossetians. Well, the Ossetians refer to themselves as Ironi. And, in other words, Irani. Even in Iran, sometimes there's a slang pronunciation of Irani as Iruni. And that's what the Ossetians called themselves. They are the last genetic remnant of the Scythian Iranians.
Interesting. And, of course, they have Ossetia is like in Russia, Georgia, parts of Turkey. It's a very interesting... Wasn't it the Ossetians that had a kind of a action against Russia at some point? It was they tried to separate, right? Wasn't that what they tried to
yes,
do?
Yes, in North Ossetia. Yeah. North Ossetia. And then South Ossetia is in Georgia. But see, those people are Iranians. They're the last remnant of the Scythian people.
This is really a second attempt, right, at an Iranian Renaissance. The claim is, of course, that the first one was a Islamic golden age and whatever. Do you want to talk a bit more about that?
Yeah, so the first 100 years of the Arab-Muslim conquest of Iran was characterized by raping, pillaging, and destruction of the kind that we're seeing replayed now with the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. These militant groups today really are an adequate reflection of the mentality that the armies of Muhammad and his immediate successors had. They went around burning libraries to the ground, defacing and destroying monuments, and worst of all, you know, carrying out murder and rape. They would take Persian noble women and sell them in markets as sex slaves. And, you know, one of the reasons why they were highly valued is because they were white. I'm sure you've seen these Orientalist paintings where, you know, you have Arabs and North Africans in a market looking at white women, right?
Indeed.
And These are the white women in those paintings, in those Orientalist paintings, they're the white women who were brought by, like, the Turks from Bulgaria to North Africa. But a much more significant genocidal campaign that involved the rape and enslavement of women took place in Iran, which, unlike Bulgaria, was a vast Aryan empire. And, you know, many of the noble women whose husbands were slaughtered wound up being sold as sex slaves. So, yeah, it was a horrible first century of the Arabian Caliphate consolidating its control over what had been the Persian Empire. And after this 100 years, the Arabs realized that they can't, you know, run an empire in this fashion. Once their initial burst of expansion had exhausted itself and they got down to the business of actually governing, they realized that they would need to employ people who were technically competent. And so the Persians wound up forming almost the entire administrative and scientific technical elite of the Arabian Caliphate, beginning around the 900s AD. Although all of the texts had to be written in Arabic because it was the official language of the caliphate, the vast majority of the scientists and scholars of this so-called Islamic Golden Age were Persians. People like Razi or Omar Khayyam, Biruni, Avicenna or Ibn Sina, Khwarizmi. These people were all ethnic Persians. Many of them from Khorasan, from that part of northwestern Iran that had been least affected genetically by the Arab conquest. So we're talking about Caucasian, Indo-European people who were producing these scientific works in a language other than their native language. And right. It's a travesty to pass this off as Islamic science.
Yeah, they've gotten the credit for this. This, you know, bears repeating. We need to continue to alert people to this issue that, you know, there's other people that have written, of course, books on this about the lie of these multicultural paradises that took place in Al-Andalus or Spain. This is what current academic professors are teaching us, that it was like when Islam came in, it was a wonderful, thriving civilization. And again, I think much in the same way that you mentioned before, the Goths or the Visigoths had a very elaborate societal structure. There was the first people outside of the Roman Empire that had those kinds of city states at that time, etc. I think a lot were lend or robbed, I should say, when the Islamic forces were pushing into some of these European areas. And then the same should be said about what happened in Iran when these Islamic forces came in there, that they're attributed to having all this philosophy, and it was a golden age of discovery, and like things such as the concept of like the camera and other kind of scientific things, alcohol and all this kind of stuff, astronomy. This was, of course, the wisdom that was already existing in the ancient world before the Muslims, poured in there and basically took that for their own benefit. And then we in the West today get to hear how wonderfully culturally enriching it was to have Muslims come into your area, right?
Yes, and again, I mean, you mentioned the Visigoths in Spain, right? Remember that Gothalonia was founded not just by Goths, but by those Scythians who call themselves Alan.
Right,
which is where the word Alan, the name Alan comes from in all the European languages. So it was like a joint Iranian-Germanic kingdom in Spain.
Yep.
And so, but to go back to the Iranian heartland for a bit, this scientific culture that gets passed off as an Islamic golden age, it had already gotten underway before the Arab-Muslim conquest. The catalyst for this was the closure of the last Platonic academies by the Byzantines who had converted to Christianity, right? So Justinian, around the 520s AD, shut down the last of the pagan academies, and the Platonic scholars from these schools fled to the capital of the Persian Empire. They were invited there by Khosrow Anushiravan, very celebrated Sasanian monarch who lived between 501 and 579. Khosrow Anushiravan had a court philosopher by the name of Bozorg Mehr. And Khosrow is particularly noteworthy for his support of science and learning. As a good Zoroastrian, he believed in enlightenment as the foundation of a just society, and so he commissioned all of these fleeing European scholars to restart their researches inside the Persian Empire at academies like the Gondishapur University in Iran. And so you had physicists and biologists and astronomers working away for a century before the Arab Muslims came and wrecked it all. And what we saw take place between the 900s and 1000s was an attempt to piece the fragments back together. You know, these translations of Greek and Latin texts were already taking place in Sasanian Iran. They were being translated into Pahlavi, the Middle Persian language, and into Syriac, another administrative language of the Persian Empire. So the translation enterprise was restarted in the 1000s after being disrupted for several hundred years on account of the Arab invasion. Who knows where we might be today? I mean, we might have cities on the face of Mars right now if we hadn't experienced this second Abrahamic disruption.
I know.
The first one being the Christianization of the Roman Empire.
I know. There's periods like this, epochs, when just science and development is eclipsed by these incoming people, you know, and everything is lost, everything is burnt, everything. And I concur. I think you're right. I think that to a certain extent we would have been far more advanced at this point in our science and technological development and progress overall if it wasn't for the incursion of many of these people. So it's a travesty. It's a travesty for sure. But the lesson, of course, then is that we can't let this happen again, because that's what's happening right now. That's what people have to keep in mind, that all of our resources, all of our efforts today, Jason, goes to try to take care of these people who want to peer into Europe and they want to be there for economic reasons and everything else. I mean, what's happened with our space programs and science and development? Nothing is left anymore. This is a travesty to human development and our ability to learn about the universe and study and all these things. It's almost like civilization grinds to a halt when these kinds of ideologies and these kinds of people stand at our doorstep and want to try to get in some way or another.
Yeah, let me give you a couple of concrete examples briefly of the kind of retarding effect that these Abrahamic ideologies have and why it's particularly perverse to call that period an Islamic golden age. So there was this Persian scientist by the name of Al-Biruni, and he was brought into the service of a Turkic conqueror, Mahmud of Ghazna, who wound up invading northern India, okay, while he was Biruni's patron. And Biruni writes a number of extraordinary scientific works, but he also has this book called Tahlil Malil Hind, or Researchers on India. And it's fascinating text because in this book, this nominally Islamic scholar really pours over details of ancient Hindu scriptures, like the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And he disabuses Muslim readers of a lot of the misconceptions that they have about Hindu philosophy. And he was well-versed in classical Greek and can engage in detailed cultural studies of Sanskrit philosophical concepts and classical Greek philosophical concepts. So he's like an Indo-European polymath. But the tragedy here is that Mahmud of Ghazna, who is his patron, is the potentate most responsible for looting northern India and violently subjugating it to Islam, going around destroying Hindu temples and forcibly converting the population to Islam. This guy was a Turco-Mongol ruler, Mahmud of Ghazna. So you can only imagine who Al-Biruni could have been if he had had some, you know, decent human being as his royal patron rather than Mahmud of Ghazna. He basically got away with doing some good research on India in the course of a genocidal Muslim campaign to turn northern India into this disaster that, you know, we know today as Pakistan. So, you know, that's one example. And then another example is Ibn Sina, or Avicenna, as he's known in the West. Avicenna wrote a number of philosophical works in the Aristotelian tradition. He made concrete contributions to the advancement of science and technology, especially in the field of medicine. His Qanun fil Tibb, or Canon of Medicine, was standard reading in Europe even into the 1700s. But Avicenna admits at the very end of his life that his more fundamental philosophical views were all a deceptive exoteric facade that he had to put up in order to avoid Muslim persecution. And he writes this one last book where he reveals his esoteric philosophy, and in the introduction he clearly states that his sources of inspiration were ancient Persian in origin. We have hardly anything left of this final book that he wrote. It was basically consigned to the flames by generations of Muslim theologians, and you know, this is terrible because the guy basically admitted, look, I had to live my life as a fraud so as not to be martyred. There was a guy, Shahab al-Din Sohrabardi, a Persian mystic from about a generation or two after Avicenna, and he picks up the project that Avicenna initiates for restoring the pre-Islamic mystical tradition, the pre-Islamic esoteric philosophy of Iran, And Shahab al-Din Sohrawardi is actually martyred. He's executed as a heretic. So Avicenna, you know, he was right in thinking that had he publicly said what he finally revealed in this deathbed confession, he probably would have been executed. And so my point is that it's really perverse to characterize this period as an Islamic golden age, because the paragons of this period, the great Persian geniuses who are the shining lights of this epoch, were constrained and crippled by Islam, if anything.
Yeah.
And had the Sasanian culture continued, we might have seen, the European Enlightenment take place in Iran around, 900 AD.
What about Sufism then, right? That's the one thing we hear all the time. That's a kind of esoteric branch of Islam, and this much more, better, people within that and all that kind of stuff. What do you have to say about that?
Well, you only really need to read the Quran seriously once to understand that Sufi ideas are fundamentally heterodox. They are absolutely heretical and would subject you to the death penalty. So the Sufi tradition, Sufi actually means Sophia. I mean, the word Sufi comes from Sophia. Yeah. I don't buy at all the etymology that traces it to suf or wool in Arabic. And it is
Sophia, which is wisdom, of course, for those who don't know.
Wisdom, yeah, wisdom in Greek. Yes, and so it's a survival of the pre-Islamic Persian mystical tradition, which is Zoroastrian and also Mithraic in origin. And you can very clearly trace the genealogy of Sufism, or quote-unquote Islamic mysticism, back to the Mazdakite heresy of the Sasanian period. The first generation of Islamic quote-unquote mystics were persecuted by theologians of the caliphate. They were charged with being Mazdakites. And this term has a very definite meaning. It means that the theologians, and they say this very clearly, the theologians of that period thought that these folks were only donning the cloak of Islam. They were disguising themselves in Islamic garb in order to avoid persecution. But really, they were adherents of the school of Mazdak. And so you had these communities, especially in the mountainous areas of northwestern Iran and in Khorasan, where people had no mosques. When people would come in from the outside, travelers would come in from the outside, they'd claim to be Muslims, but they had no mosques, they had no Friday sermons, they drank, women were treated as equals. Some even observed, free love practices in these communities.
Uh-oh.
So they were hardly Muslims. And if you look at their theology, the metaphysics that they have and their cosmology is a direct continuation of ideas from the Sasanian period. Ideas that also reflect the influence of Platonism. You remember I was talking about how Khosrow invited those Platonist academicians to the Sasanian court after they were kicked out of the Eastern Roman Empire. You also see a lot of Neoplatonic ideas in Sufism that wound up being integrated into Zoroastrianism during the Sasanian period. So people like Rumi, right, who are often appealed to as a source of moderation in Islam, are really people who whitewashed Islam and tried to create a form of Islam that was tolerable to the Persian mind, which, as we talked about in a previous interview, was a coping mechanism for a colonized population.
Right. Yeah, because I'm fascinated how Sufism still then, despite all these things, managed to survive. Is there any, I mean, maybe there is tension there, and maybe there's part of Sufism that is kind of, people know that it's unacceptable, whatever, but somehow it managed to be accepted. Somehow it still managed to retain itself as a part of Islamic tradition, which I find kind of interesting.
It's because Shiism was established as the state religion of Iran. You remember that Shah Ismail I was talking about, who had the red hair from the Caucasus, that we have this beautiful European portrait of him. Shah Ismail was a Sufi. He was from a Sufi order. So not only was he a brilliant military tactician, he was also a mystic and an esoteric initiate, you could say. The Safaviyya, the name of the clan or group that the Safavid dynasty comes from, the Safaviyya were an esoteric order. And so when Shah Ismail adopts Shiite Islam as the state religion of Safavid Iran, he is trying to erect a barrier between Iran and the Sunni Arab world. Shiism really begins as an Arab dispute over the succession to Muhammad. And there's nothing mystical about it. If you go back and you read the sermons of Ali, the first imam of the Shiites and the fourth Arabian caliph, if you go back and you read the sermons of Ali, I mean, in a way, it's more barbaric than Muhammad even and the Quran. So you certainly can't trace Shiite esotericism back to Imam Ali, or I would say even his children, Hassan and Hussein and so forth, who were martyred and whose martyrdom becomes foundational for the Shiite identity. Esotericism was injected into Shiism around the 900s by these Mazdakite groups. They knew that because there was this dispute between these two rival Arab factions, they could use the minority insurgent status of the Shia in order to carve out a space of autonomy from the Arabian Caliphate. So they wound up claiming to be Shia and superficially adopting and adapting elements of Arab Shiism in order to create a neo-Zoroastrian Persian national religion. One of the groups that really exemplifies this are the Assassins. The Order of the Assassins that was led by Hassan Sabah in Alamut Fortress, and who fought on the one hand against the European Crusaders, but also against the Sunni Arab Caliphate. The Assassins are essentially a Mazdakite neo-Zoroastrian group that has cloaked themselves in Islamic garb in order to stage an insurgency against the caliphate. Mm-hmm. Hassan Sabah famously adopted Persian as the liturgical language of the Ismaili Shiite sect that he led. That's another indicator of their Persian cultural identity, of the fact that these people saw themselves as Iranians and were using Shiism to erect a barrier between Iran and the Sunni Arab world. So I think that Sufism survived in the form of Shiite esotericism, because after all, the majority of the Sufi tradition consists of Persian poets. The language of Sufism is the Persian language. And so the Sufi tradition survived because Iran survived by setting up this Shiite barrier to Sunni Arab Islam. Of course, today, the youth in Iran have realized that that has far outlived its usefulness, this, Shia barrier, mm-hmm. This lie, this dissimulation, or taghiyya, as they call it, that they are actually Muslims. It has far outlived its usefulness, and frankly, they have stopped believing their own bullshit that they ever really became Muslims in the first place.
Jason, this is very, very interesting. There's a whole history here that we know so little about, I know so little about, and I think many people as well, in terms of both an Indo-Aryan tradition, where it comes from, the roots, but also how it was pushed out when the Islamic, incursions began. And how, of course, Iran suffered during this as well. And this is something that we're also going to talk more about in the second hour, or the second segment, I should say. We've gone for quite a while in the first segment here, which is fine. This is very interesting. But we're going to talk more about the Shah of Iran, kind of the his project of the great civilization, and discuss a bit more about the Islamist takeover that I mentioned in the beginning. Because we've had things such as, the Arab Spring and all these issues, the rise of ISIS. you know, how this modern kind of version of Islam, how that relates to what we've been talking about. So that's something we're going to do more in the second segment as we continue. But I just wanted to let you guys know there as well that Jason will be speaking at the London Forum this Saturday, as this show goes up on Thursday, February 2nd. So you can still make that if you're in the area. So that's Saturday, the 4th of February. So definitely check that out. Where's the tickets for that, Jason, by the way? The London Forum, I guess it's the website to go to.
Yeah, I believe so. And let's also remind listeners, Henrik, that there are going to be links on this page to all of the various articles that I've written about Iran and its influence on European culture. So if folks want to, you know, go into a more detailed analysis of the various concepts and ideas that we're discussing, that would be the place to look.
Now, does the Iranian Renaissance has a, you know, the Aryan Imperium, the thing that you guys are trying to reboot and restart again. Is there any official, like, websites and stuff for this? Is there any communication with the outside world, or is a lot of this kind of still under the radar and somewhat secret?
No, we have a website. I mean, I'll go more into that in the second segment, but we do have a website. Unfortunately, the English language website so far has very little content on it as compared to the Persian site, which, by the way, this is important because it shows you this is an organic, legitimate Iranian cultural movement. It's not something that's being contrived by elites in the West. You know, many of the leaders in the Iranian Renaissance movement don't really speak English. And I see that actually as a good thing because it means it's a homegrown cultural revolution.
That's an interesting point, because we have to ask ourselves that. Why is the interest so so prominent by these globalists to try to control much of the Arab world and Iran and the interest there in supporting? I mean, think about that, folks. I mean, they were supporting toppling of a republic of a I don't know if it was democratic, but the toppling of the Shah to put in place an Islamic ruler, basically, which is of course supposedly what America now is fighting in all this stuff, right? It's very interesting. So we're going to get more into detail about that. But just a final note in this, of course, check out Jason's book, Prometheus and Atlas. He is now over at arctos.com. And of course, together with many of us, other folks in the alt-right, alt-right.com is the website for that. But yeah, Jason, let's take a short break and we will be back with the second segment. Stay tuned, everyone. More interesting stuff is coming up. We'll be right back. Well, stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. Second hour coming up with Jason Reza Georgiani. We're going to continue our conversation in this long expose of Iranian history, and we're going to move further into the modern era and discuss what's happened with the various revolution, like the Arab Spring, and certain movements that have propped up from outside forces and globalists to try to steer Iran in, according to their opinions, right direction. So we'll get more into that in the second hour. If you want to hear that, go to redicemembers.com, our members' website. When you sign up for a membership with us, you get full access to all our previous shows. We have over 1,200 of them now. We also, of course, do a live TV show on the weekends, exclusive for members, and we're adding a lot of segments to this all the time as well. So if you like what we do, do support us. Make sure that we can continue, grow, and expand. RedIceMembers.com is the website. Go there. We'll talk to you on the other side of the break.